extent of that cooperation since you worked in both the U.S. and the U.K. nuclear weapons establishments?
And the answer to that is definitely yes. It was quite revolutionary when the U.K. government wrote the RFP that they specifically stated they would be willing to entertain U.S. companies as part of a joint venture, but that whoever that company might turn out to be couldn't own more than 50% of the joint venture. They wanted to be sure that the majority ownership remained in U.K. company hands, but that they were willing to entertain a U.S. company as a member. Because absent the 58 agreement and all of the structure that is in it, which allows exchange of people from one program to the other, absent that agreement, it, of course, could never have happened because, in effect, you had a U.S. company engaged in U.K. defense business, which is specifically forbidden by law for individuals, unless they get permission from the State Department, for individuals to from the U.S. to engage in defense activities of another country. So, yeah, the 58 agreement was key to that ever happening. And, of course, the consortium is still in place, still operating AWE. And I think people are, the U.K. people, that is, the U.K. government people, are happy with the relationship. I see them frequently. In fact, I saw two of the government people just last night for dinner. Anyway, and then there was a fellow who was over here who represents the name. Oh, Robin Pittman.
Yes.
Robin Pittman. And a colleague of his who's in the U.K. Navy side of procurement, who was also over here attending a meeting yesterday that was being run by Los Alamos and Livermore on nuclear programs between, well, really, the U.S. nuclear program, but they invited the U.K. to attend.
Oh.
So the rest of the story, of course, is the 58 agreement, as I'm sure you've heard by now, is heavily influenced by the ongoing working groups between the two countries, the JOAGs, the IVERS, the this, the that. You know, they all get names, but it's quite an active interaction. All including classified information under controls. Oh, thank you very much.
I don't need that.
Thank you. The thing that I observe is that often it's viewed from the U.S. side, since I've been on both sides, often it's viewed from the U.S. side as being tilted towards aiding the U.K. program because it's much smaller than the U.S. program. But the reality is the interaction provides a good check and balance on ideas that are developed, on technical work that's performed in the U.S. program, which otherwise would largely go unreviewed by what you might describe as an external technical body of some sort. Now, granted, from time to time you have the JASONs that get asked to look at the U.S. nuclear weapon program. You have the National Academy of Sciences that occasionally gets asked to look at it. But none of those external U.S. reviews ever have the close interaction that occurs through those JOAGs. So, in fact, I think the U.S. program gets a lot out of the relationship. You can argue that perhaps the U.K. program does get more because it essentially draws from the U.S. program's roughly 10 times the size of the U.K. program. In dollars or pounds or however you want to measure it. So it really is a 10-to-1 kind of numbers game in terms of the people who are engaged. But the problems are the same. You know, in both cases, you're talking about the design, the development, the production, the fielding, the maintenance, the surveillance of a nuclear weapon. And not surprisingly, our nuclear weapons and theirs are in some ways similar. So it's easy for either side, whether it's the UK looking at a US nuclear weapon problem or the U.S. looking at a U.K. nuclear weapon problem, it's easy for people to look at it and say, oh, I've seen that problem before. Mm-hmm. You know, I know what you're talking about. You're talking about this. I know what you're talking about, and I can, let's proceed. Let's go work on that. It's not as if you have to get up to speed and explain, well, you know, this is the front end of the weapon and this is the back end of the weapon. All that's understood. They're all technical experts. And so the relationship is has been very, I think, very useful to both countries.
I've read that you were involved, your earlier part, as a physicist, your earlier part of your career was in research at Sandia. So you speak very highly of the kind of exchanges and the usefulness, but do you think that you always had that opinion when you might have been part of the, I don't know if you were part of the JOAGS in the beginning, but... Or do you think maybe as you moved into more management and directive positions that then you developed a more understanding of how useful the MDA could be?
Yeah, it's certainly true. Early in my career, when I was still mainly doing research or even engineering, I was not at all close to the nuclear weapon program at Sandia. I didn't get acquainted with it until quite a bit later, the early to mid-'80s. And even then, from the Sandia perspective, looking at what I saw, I'm sure I would have said the Brits get a lot more out of this than the Yanks do. Yeah. And it took the exposure to both sides of it, I think, to see it more extensively from both the UK view and from the US view for me to develop this view, this appreciation for what the UK scientists bring to the relationship. End of story.
So when you left the position of deputy chief executive at the AWE to become the deputy administrator for defense programs at an NSA, you said that one of the high items on your agenda was to improve the relationship between the AWE and the U.S. laboratories, saying that some of the valuable personal relations were lost after the cessation of underground testing. How did you go about achieving that goal, and did you succeed, or is there still work being done?
Well, from my perspective, and this sort of dates back, really dated back to the late 80s when the UK shared the test site in Nevada and conducted their test program at the Nevada test site very infrequently, but nonetheless that's where they conducted it, because when they stopped their atmospheric testing program at Christmas Island, they had no capability for underground testing except at the Nevada test site. We offered it up as available to them on a pay-your-own-way kind of basis. And so I was aware of their activities at the Nevada test site. And not much, simply because of the job I had at Sandia, I interfaced with the weapon. I had a responsibility for a while for the weapons effects activities. And as such, those field experiments were done on underground tests at Nevada. So I interfaced occasionally with the UK activities at the test site. That was my exposure to them early on. So by the time I got back to NNSA in 01, 02, I was much more sensitized to the fact that, one, the UK needed the relationship to be successful, and two, the US although they might not know it as well as I thought I did, the U.S. program could benefit more from the U.K. relationship than they realized. And I knew from my exposure at AWE that it had to be a two-way trade. Otherwise, you can't really get the work done in the U.S. program that you wanted to get done, because in those JOAGs, or in most all of the activities, each side pays their own way. So it's not as if the U.K. sends over money aside for special situations. On a normal basis, U.K. doesn't send over money for U.S. people to work on programs that are either of joint interest or perhaps of primary interest to the U.K. It's done on a sort of collegial, we both will benefit from this at kind of basis. And so you have to have a collegial cooperative relationship between the two programs, or it doesn't work. You know, UK comes over and says, you know, we sure would like to work with you on this particular problem because we're having trouble with it. And the US guys sit around the table and say, well, okay, we're interested in that problem too, so we'll go work on it, and we want the results, and we'll obviously share the results with you. And then UK guy says, okay, and I'll go back and I'll work on it on my side, and we'll get together and we'll compare. That's effective collaboration. The ineffective side is when, you know, you can't find anyone who will talk to you in the U.S. program for whatever reason. So it can easily bog down into the latter, and it takes a lot of, not necessarily arm twisting, but talk and sitting around and looking at the program priorities of the two countries to convince people that there's good reason to have this interaction succeed. Mm-hmm. But it's never easy because of the fact that each side pays their own way, and you've got one guy at the table who's a much smaller program than the other guy. So the people sitting over here from Los Alamos or Livermore or Sandia sit there and think to themselves, you know, we're doing most of the work, and they're getting all the benefit. If you aren't careful, that's the way they react, in which case the relationship doesn't work. So you have to look for areas where the UK side can clearly contribute to a problem in a way that the U.S. side clearly will benefit. Then it's two-way. Then it works.
It's interesting because of the length of this this agreement and this cooperation. There have been so many changes in the international environment. Early on, it's been portrayed as having the MDA made a lot more sense because what the British couldn't reciprocate in technical information, they made up for in political leverage and political support. Mm-hmm. And it seems that your career has really been on, you know, after the Cold War, after the need for maintaining a close, you know, a cooperative deterrent. And so do you think that there have been a lot more political obstacles that you've had to overcome because of that? And in what capacity were you, in what positions were you in to navigate those and maybe make the political environment more apt for information sharing?
I wasn't as involved during the Cold War, you're right, when the perhaps the political and the intelligence sharing was more important than it was after, say, 1990 or thereabouts. But what replaced it was the somewhat parallel paths that the programs took in the UK and in the US. Both of them sort of went into a decline starting in the early 90s because everybody looked around and said, wait a minute, you know, the enemy went away. Yeah. So why do we need all these nuclear weapons? Why do we need these big establishments spending all this money? Let's make everything smaller. So you had a move in the UK, very much parallel to the move in the US, to shrink the complex. They had effectively three sites, one main site at Aldermaston, but two others. And of course, the US had something like 12 or so that they shrank down to 8. So both programs went through the early 90s reducing their field operations down to a smaller complex and learning to adjust to a political environment in which the imperatives were not nearly as obvious as to why there needed to be a vigorous nuclear weapon program at all. So in that, what came out of that that I saw, because I was engaged at this point, was the fact that, one, within the nuclear weapon program on each side, this concept of stockpile stewardship and replacing a lot of the previous testing and development program for new weapons with science, which was sort of the keystone to the whole concept of stockpile stewardship. It was a good strategy in both countries, and it was followed in both countries because it was a strategy which it could be argued, if you're on the American side or on the UK side, to your own government, it could be argued that, look, we're working hand in hand with the Brits, or if you're the British side, you could say we're working hand in hand with the Americans to develop these new paths to maintaining a stockpile in an environment which is very different from where it was previously. So even in the early 90s, as everybody was shrinking, this whole the ideas were being developed jointly. I would say the U.S. did a lot more original thinking on it and had a lot more money to spend. So not surprisingly, they had the bigger program, and the U.K. filled in as best they could. And then, lo and behold, since the stockpiles, their stockpile and the U.S. stockpile were sort of the same age, in the late 90s and now in the early 2000s and mid-2000s, both countries are coming into a point in time in which they have to make changes to the stockpile under conditions where they can no longer test, because testing was stopped in the early 90s. And that was one of the reasons why stockpile stewardship was born. So now I would say 2008, more than any time since, maybe more than any time ever, but certainly more than any time since the early 90s, both countries are finding it to their advantage to have technical experts from outside their own program looking at their program to give them a second opinion. The whole question of certification without testing when you make changes to the stockpile, as you do life extension programs, as you contemplate developing more secure, more easily maintained weapons, in this country called RRW. The UK, they have a different name for it, but it's the same concept. So the programs continue very much to move along parallel paths. One's still much bigger than the other, but they still are going along these parallel paths and are very useful, I think, to both sides.
I had the opportunity to interview a friend of yours, Ambassador Linton Brooks, earlier, and he spoke of in terms of modernizing the stockpile or the weapons and ROWs, the U.S. has not had as much success in getting the funding that the U.K. side has. And he related that to the fact that the U.K. had a much more clear nuclear policy outlined so they were able to move ahead with modernizing because they didn't get into discussions on role of defenses, et cetera, that happened in the U.S. And I'm wondering if you think that now that the U.K. do you think that there's advantages for our own program in what the UK has been able to achieve?
Yeah, there's two parts to that answer. The first part is when you see both governments and the way they work, from either from the government side or from the contractor side, you realize that the parliamentary system, which the UK has, is indeed much less complex and much less difficult to deal with in program decisions. The Prime Minister, well, the government in the UK can develop its position, take it forward to the Prime Minister. Prime Minister can approve it, and he can pretty well get that approval then in the Parliament so that the money can be relied upon for many for multiple years, and you don't end up every year having to go back and revisit all the old problems and recognize that you've got a new congressman here and a new senator there and some new staffers here that you suddenly discover are hurdles that you have to get across year after year after year. No question about it. Their process is a much more friendly one to deal with in terms of getting a decision and it sticking and the funding being available then to go forward. Now, the downside to it is everything is it does take longer because they have less money to work with. Their bureaucracy really is pretty convoluted in and of itself, so that things don't really necessarily go faster if the U.S. program is on a smooth path, has been approved, and you're going forward to develop something, manufacture it, get it out in the field. The U.S. program can move faster under those circumstances. It's just that in the world today, where there's so much contention over the role of nuclear weapons, UK program's moving along in a much more controlled way than the U.S. program. And it's getting ahead in terms of approvals, money being committed, and their planning. Now, at the end of the day, a phrase which I picked up in the UK, at the end of the day, I imagine the U.S. program will catch up again because it can move faster and there'll be more money available and eventually it'll happen. But right now, U.S. program's in a mess. U.K. program's moving right along.
Yeah. Among the issues you mentioned, there's been much discussion about a missing generation of scientists with the lack of testing, and it's been difficult to recruit younger scientists and revitalize the U.S. program. How do you think that could be improved?
Yeah, I think that's not necessarily the reality. People speak of that. And indeed, it's now been more than 15 years since the last test. But both programs have been running pretty well on, so to speak, the people who were early in their career and have stayed with the program and are just now getting pretty close to retirement, or some have already retired. So the problem is now showing up as people who were maybe 10 years into their career in 1990, they're now literally at retirement age. But they've been most of them have been available. Some left the program, but you've had key people who were engaged in testing. You can find them now, still at Sandias, at Los Alamos, at Livermore. You still find a few dozen people who are senior now but were engaged in the test program at the time. But they are retiring fairly rapidly now. And so you're going to find yourself in another 5 years with probably no one at any of the U.S. labs or at any of the U.K. labs who has ever tested a nuclear weapon. No one. That's the problem you have to worry about, is handing off this knowledge to the next generation. But they've hired a lot of young people in the last 15 years. Stockpile stewardship has made that possible because it was attractive. You know, it wasn't just a dead program. was a program where you were trying to inject science and a lot of new tools, scientific tools. And so it was exciting to be a part of it because of all the new things that you could do that had never been done before. NIF, DART, you name it. Lots of really neat capabilities. So you've brought new people along. The question is, if you now look around one day and say, you know, there's not a single person in the room here who ever tested a nuclear weapon, how confident are we that we know what we're talking about? That's the problem of the future that I think is the one that all the world is going to learn to deal with, all the world that we associate with. British program, the French program, the Russian program, the U.S. program. They're all in the same position.
So do you have any, what are your hopes for the future of nuclear cooperation between the U.S. and the U.K.? And do you have any advice you'd like to pass on to the next administration?
I do think it requires conscious effort on the part of senior people in the U.S. program to recognize the benefits of the relationship. It's more than just going to England twice a year to have a good time, to look at the beautiful countryside, or perhaps to get rained all over in the dark of December, which is really pretty grim. You did? It's even worse in Scotland, isn't it? Yeah, and where I lived, it was, you know, it was dark by 4 o'clock in the afternoon and probably raining. And driving back and forth was really unpleasant. But anyway, it does take effort. The UK knows they need help from the U.S. program more than the U.S. knows, if you just talk to average guy working in the program. More than the U.S. knows, they need help from the U.K. So it takes effort. But I think it'll pay off, and over time it'll pay off all the more because we're confronted with a common problem. That is, people do get older, year at a time. And the big issues will continue to be, since I believe this country is going to have a nuclear stockpile of some size forever, because I have a hard time believing that you'll ever eliminate all nuclear weapons from the face of the earth. As long as there are nuclear weapons, this country has to be first among equals, or first without question in the world. So, and our history tells us that our most reliable partner in defense and in nuclear matters is the UK. So we better guard this relationship. We better not let some bureaucrats here or there or wherever decide one day that for some reason we're not going to continue this relationship for whatever reason. That would be a very bad decision. It has to be guarded, first of all, politically, and then secondly, it has to be guarded in terms of keeping it an effective relationship. You may sometimes find it hard to see exactly what you're getting out of it, but you don't want to let it slip away. You don't have very many tools available now. Most of the most valuable thing you have is the ability of smart people to analyze problems. And you need for it to be as a broad working relationship. And historically, I think we have all, anyone who's been around it as long as I have at least, have tended to look at it and say, you know, it may not happen often, but it does happen from time to time that we get something really useful out of that relationship. And there's no way you get it unless you keep the relationship alive. So that would sort of be my message.
Thank you so much, Dr. Everett Beckner.
Okay.